This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Keeping an eye on these changes then, the comings and the goings down at number 10. Nicky Morgan appointed as the new Education Secretary. Of course, we were covering that while we had Sir Michael Wilshaw from Ofsted on. And he was mourning there the fact that Michael Gove will move on, said that he was a very committed man and had certain ideas and ideals he wanted to put in place. Let's see how they're reacting more, though, on the shop floor. Dr. Mary Bowsett is General Secretary of the Association of Teachers and Lecturers. I'll put to you the same question that I put to Sir Michael, Dr. Bowsett. Will they be dancing in the common rooms and the staff rooms of schools today?
I think they will, actually, yes. I think that Michael Gove, with all the things that he did, one of the things he did do was manage to become one of the most despised and disliked education secretaries.
And why do you suppose that was, Dr. Bowsett?
Because time after time he chased newspaper headlines rather than engaging with the profession. He was always very, very free to criticise, often very unfairly, teachers, and to not acknowledge the very, very difficult and challenging work that they do. And I think also David Cameron has actually realised that there are a whole raft of things which now need clearing up, because Michael Gove was a great ideologue, but his ideas didn't always work, and that's becoming abundantly clear.
Nicky Morgan, then, is the new Education Secretary, stood as the Conservative candidate for Loughborough in the 2005 general election, again in 2010 when she became MP. She's one of the new intake, Dr. Bowsett.
Yes, she is. I don't really know much about her. I've been waiting to go on the programme. I've just been looking her up on the web, and I understand that she's well-liked in the Conservative Party and that she's pragmatic and wants to get things working. So I'm hoping that we're going to have a more constructive relationship with her. And don't get me wrong, I understand, as everyone does, that teacher union leaders are not always going to agree with Conservative Secretary of State for Education. That's fine, that's understood, we can deal with that. What I do hope is that when we have a disagreement, it will be done with courtesy. And that if you have a different view than her, you will not be just routinely condemned and insulted, which was too often what Michael Gove did.
And you felt that you were sometimes routinely condemned and insulted?
Yes, absolutely. I'm somebody who's worked for 30 years in education. I was an outstanding teacher. I had achieved very successful educational standards for the pupils I taught. I've worked very hard at the profession and at my subject. And even if you don't agree with what I say, I deserve to be listened to with a modicum of respect.
Thank you for your time. Dr. Mary Bowsett is General Secretary of the Association of Teachers and Lecturers. I'm not sure if we've given this to you on the LBC News. My apologies, because I was working during Lisa's news bulletin. Philip Hammond is the new Foreign Secretary. Have we made that? We have already told you that. So just to reinforce that, Philip Hammond has now gone to the Foreign Office. As I say, I was working during Lisa's news bulletin. If anything else comes along, we'll let you know. Be sure to listen. A full update, of course, just over, 15 minutes or so away. Let's come back to the conversation we were having just before the Chief Inspector of Schools of Ofsted, Sir Michael Wilshaw, came on. And it was an education-related story. This is a school in East London that had started a policy for children in Ramadan. It's a primary school, remember, I stress, it's a primary school. Had started a policy for Ramadan, which then had to change after parents' complaints about asking people to be taken home so they could have a break. I asked Sir Michael whether he agreed with it in principle.
Absolutely not right. At all. You know, that they've got to... If youngsters... during Ramadan need somewhere to rest, then the school has got to put that provision on, but they should not be sending them home.
And the idea of primary school children fasting as well, that must be of concern. It would appear, we've spoken to imams, it would appear it's when you reach puberty that you start fasting if you're that for 10-year-olds.
Well, you know, that is part of their faith. They're very committed to it, and in many ways that's something to be lauded, that they are so committed to their faith.
And a school's place is to educate, surely. That's what schools are put on earth to do.
It is, but, you know, in the schools that I ran, there were significant numbers of Muslim kids who were very committed to their faith, and we provided the opportunities for them to worship during Ramadan. And if they felt ill in any way, then because they were fasting, then we would ensure that there was provision to help and support them.
Tahir's in Ilford on this. Tahir.
Hello, Nick. How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you, mate. What can you tell me?
I was just commenting on the discussion today in terms of people fasting.
Oh, yes.
I fasted all my life since the age of 9.
Right.
And I've fasted in different professions as well. I've worked for the Metropolitan Police for the last 22 years.
Yes.
I've fasted as a 999 dispatch controller.
Right.
I've fasted in Pakistan as well, when right. the temperatures are really hot.
Yeah.
I've fasted everywhere.
How much does it interfere with your concentration?
On a late turn, when you're dealing with 999 calls, it's difficult anyway. Mm. And not drinking as well at the same time.
What do they do with surgeons in Islamic countries, Tahir?
I'm not an expert on Islamic countries, but I imagine in Islamic countries you have police officers, you have doctors, you have all sorts of people, and there's a billion of us around the world.
No, I know, but would you want to be operated? The word that other people used was sluggish. Would you want a sluggish surgeon?
I could be sluggish for a whole heap of reasons. I could have a long night out, drinking session, come back to work, and I could be sluggish in the morning. Mm. I could have lack of sleep because I've been out. There could be a whole heap of reasons. So just for the fact that somebody isn't drinking or eating, I know it's difficult for people who haven't fasted to understand, but it's not, it's a billion people who are doing it in the world. It's not the most difficult of things to do. I've done it all my life.
Okay. Tahir, thank you. Tavia is in Hackney to talk about fasting. Tavia, 9, 10-year-olds, what do you say?
I think it's ridiculous, Nick. I'm really sorry. Every time something comes up with Muslims, it's like, especially I find in this country, they're bent over backwards to accommodate them, which I think is ridiculous.
Right.
And that's the reason I think, I believe that's why maybe the British people are a bit fed up with foreigners, because, I mean, I'm a Jamaican, but I was brought up in Germany. And there's lots of foreigners in Germany as well, but I've never seen them accommodate, they don't bend over backwards for nobody.
Is it wrong to be? Is it wrong to be accommodating?
You know what, Nick? I think not necessarily wrong, but I think when you bend it over backwards, that I mean, whatever they ask for is that they get. And I think sometimes that's why I think you have these. Now you have to bring in terrorist law and all that because they want a mosque, they get a mosque.
Tavia, we're talking about 9-year-old children. We don't need a terrorist law to stop them fasting.
I know, but I'm sorry, Nick. I think at 9 they're too young anyway. They're just too young.
Here's my view. So, did you say you were educated in Germany?
Yeah.
What I would say is, look, if you want your children to fast, that's absolutely fine. But schools will not have to change policies, have to have special policies, have to have parents come.
Exactly.
We are there, and I just wonder if that's how it would be in Germany, which is if you're Muslim and you want to do that, that's fine. But the primary role of a school is to teach.
The school will not... there was a couple of girls in our class, from what I can remember... And they were Pakistanis, and they did fast. They had their Ramadan as well, but the school never changed. Made no provision whether it was primary school, secondary school. They never made no provision. We didn't even. I mean, I've never even knew there was Ramadan. I think until I came to this country at 17, because it was not something that was broadcasted. If they had like their, my eldest daughter went to school in Newham, and they had there was Guru Nanak. Then the school was closed for that. I done all sorts of Asian holidays, and the school was closed. And I'm a working mum, but now my two youngest daughters, they go to school in Harrodwood because that's where we live now. And there's none of that. I mean, it's just the normal holidays, like standard, like the week in February, the summer holidays, the Christmas period. There's no extra day off in November. I don't know.
Thank you for that. Remails coming in on our conversation we're having with Sir Michael Wilshire about Michael Gove leaving as Education Secretary. Jan says he speaks without thinking, that's the problem, and our children are at the raw end of it. That's what I object to. Meanwhile, Tess are completely different. The hope for the children is gone. The best minister is out. Cameron is useless. Saeed's in Hounslow. You're on the radio, Saeed. Hello.
Hi, Nick. It's my first time talking to you on the
show. Thank you for coming on.
I wanted to very quickly touch on first, children fasting below the age of 13.
Mm.
Number two, should surgeons be fasting? And number three, what are the benefits of it? I'll try to keep it very, very brief.
Well, if you're going to do all the three, you will keep it brief. Go ahead, do it in that order then.
When we were kids, we were never told that we're obliged to fast below the age of 15.
And the only reason
sometimes we would fast is because we wanted to follow what our parents were doing.
That's fine.
They would only allow us to do that under their supervision. So only on a day when we're not going to school, when they know that we're going to be in front of them the whole day.
So, do you agree with me? This primary school in Leighton shouldn't be getting involved in all of this.
I agree with you.
Thank you.
On
good.
This one,
okay. Point two, surgeons.
Surgeons. So in Islam, there is provision if you have a valid reason that you cannot fast.
No, I know that. I know if you're travelling or if you're sick. But hang on, hold on. Excuse me. If you're a surgeon, the chances are you're going to be operating maybe 2 or 3 days a week. You'll never stop your fast. You make up. I understand how you make up for it. I get all of that. So that if you're travelling or if you're ill or if a woman's in a certain time in her cycle, I get all of that. I know that. But this surgeon will never ever catch up because he's having to fast, or she's having to fast 3 days. Sorry, additional 3 days a week.
If I were a surgeon, and I knew that my sluggishness could affect somebody's,
well, of course it could.
Life,
there's no if, is there?
Yes.
Do you want a dentist drilling your teeth? And bear in mind, it was a Muslim young Muslim woman who used the word sluggishness, Yumuna. Do you want a Muslim dentist drilling your teeth who's sluggish?
If I was a surgeon, I wouldn't fast, and I would go for the alternative, which is if I'm well off enough, I would arrange a meal for 20 less well off people, 24 people.
Can you do that?
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
So I could become a Muslim.
If you're not able to fast for whatever valid reason, and being a surgeon and operating on people is a very valid reason, then what you would do is not fast that day and arrange for food for 20 people for a day if you're able to.
Got it. Oh, but I still have to fast other days. So I can't do these banquets every day to get out of fasting if I become a Muslim. Maybe I won't become a Muslim.
If you're a religious person and if you want to practice the religion, it's your personal choice.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Been described as very bold, the Prime Minister's decision earlier this week to bring in so many women at the top tier. How did you respond? How do you react to it? Was it bold?
Yeah, I think it's a big change for the Conservatives. As I said earlier, I actually think in terms of policy, in terms of things that actually kind of change, rather than just the kind of faces that change, it seems to me the big change has been the removal of some of the more moderate internationalist voices like Dominic Reeve, like Ken Clark from the Conservative Party. I think it's very revealing that literally 24 hours later, it appears to come out that the Conservative Party have now cleared the way through this reshuffle to a much more extreme approach, for instance, against international human rights.
So Jeremy Wright you're talking about, he's a headbanger.
No, I'm not saying he's a headbanger. I think there's been a long debate within the Conservative Party.
You could call them headbangers.
Sorry?
You did call them headbangers.
I think the headbangers have won the argument in favour of basically tearing up a long cross-party consensus that this country should stand up for the international human rights conventions, which, by the way, British politicians and British lawyers first drafted in the aftermath of the Second World War, and that we use constantly to reproach tyrants around the world. And the moment you basically say, which is what the Conservatives appear to say, they're going to get themselves into a terrible twist, by the way, about trying to do it in a sort of clever way. The principle remains the same. The moment you say that the government of the day, with a significant majority in Parliament, can drive through Parliament a rewriting of human rights disciplines, you are basically accepting that human rights provisions are not universal, that they are pick and choose. And I just have this visceral view that human rights are not there as a sort of pick and choose menu. You either believe in human rights or you don't. It's not, human rights are not in the eye of the beholder. They are fundamental rights that belong to all human beings.
So
that's why they're called human rights.
Not to be touched in any way, shape or form.
Well, we made a coalition agreement commitment, and I insisted on this personally, that yes, of course, let's look at reform of the court in Strasbourg, the European Court on Human Rights. Make it more efficient. Make sure that there are fewer cases clogging it up. Make sure that where cases can be dealt with nationally, they're dealt with nationally. But at the end of the day, the principle, and it's a really important principle to defend, that human rights are not the plaything of national governments, because that's basically what the Conservatives are saying. They'll dress it up, by the way, and say, oh, it should be Parliament, not judges. Don't be fooled by that, because actually, of course, under the system here, if you have a future Conservative government with a thumping great big majority, they can tell Parliament whatever they want. So it's about the government of the day basically saying, we are going to rewrite human rights as we want, not as people for decades have said should be internationally recognised as human rights.
And lastly, on the reshuffle, how did you feel when you heard the news that Michael Gove was moving on?
I wish him luck and...
Why are you smiling?
Well, because it's well known that Michael Gove and I had our differences, but profound differences. I mean,
but that's politics, isn't it?
That is politics, sure. I'll tell you what I think. I think it is an opportunity for us to... And I'm I don't know, I'm assuming in a quiet moment he can see this. It's a good moment for us to turn the page on what I think had become a really destructive relationship between the Department for Education and many, many teachers across the country. I mean, meet many teachers across the country, really good teachers, teachers who want to do well for the children in their care, in their classrooms, who felt really sort of felt quite offended by the way in which Michael Gove, or maybe it was his team, appeared to just brand all teachers as, remember what they said, a blob, that all teachers somehow weren't doing a proper job, all teachers were resistant to change, all teachers were resistant to reform. And I thought that was a sort of divide and rule approach to teaching, which doesn't get the best out of our teachers. I've got kids in school. Anyone who's got kids in school, you want to get the best out of your teachers. There are good teachers, there are bad teachers. There are teachers that are up for change, there are teachers who aren't. But you don't get the best out of teachers by simply just branding them all as folk who don't want to try and do their best. And that's why I like to think that with a change of personnel, we can now turn the page. And instead of denigrating teachers, we can celebrate what many, many teachers across the country do.
And it is a promotion for Mr. Gove, is it?
That is apparently, yes.
Do you see it as a promotion?
I think it's a move to a more political position. And Michael Gove is he's a talented guy. I mean, he and I may disagree on a bunch of things, but he's a talented guy, he's a colourful guy, he's a bright guy, he's a fervent conservative. He'll want to, if I understand it correctly, the move, according to the conservatives, is to give him more of a seat at the kind of top table on how the Conservative Party is going to seek to do well in the election next year. And I wish him luck in that. But what I'm saying is I think it is actually quite a good time now, and I'm very keen to do this because we're doing some really good things in education. The pupil premium, something I've been championing for years. The free school meals we're going to be introducing across the country in September. Really good, bold, progressive policy. All these things are positive things, and I'd like teachers, or more teachers than is currently the case, to feel positive about who they are, to feel valued for what they do, and to feel excited about some of the policies we're implementing.
We must move on to other calls. Deputy Prime Minister.
Aisha in Hounslow. Hello, Aisha.
Hello.
Hello.
I've got a bit of a long question.
Right.
My question is, considering Ofsted monitor schools and we know how far the Trojan horse situation has come, what will be done about it now? And also, can you assure those British Muslims who are law-abiding that we won't be scrutinised by the radical Muslims in the country for showing our loyalty to the country?
Yeah. Are you Muslim?
I am.
And do you feel, because I think it's implied in your question, it's very important this, we've talked about this on this show before, do you feel that you've been kind of, how can I put it, stereotyped or painted in a similar corner with people with more extreme views that you don't share?
I do.
Yeah.
I do feel like
Aisha, I have massive amount of sympathy for you because we need to work with people like you, sort of mainstream, law-abiding, patriotic British Muslims who are, and I'm assuming you feel this, who are as appalled by extremism, and particularly violent extremism, as anybody else. And we need to work with you because you are the role model, if you like, of the kind of British Muslim beliefs and values that everybody can share. And I do worry that sometimes some of the rhetoric around this can stereotype all Muslims as if everybody from every part of this country somehow holds extreme and undesirable views. That is clearly not the case. Islam, as you know better than I do, Aisha, is a peace-loving religion. Islam does not believe in violence. It abhors violence. And we need people like you to come on shows like this to say, I, as a Muslim, I have nothing to do with people who advocate division and hate and violence. Much as, by the way, everybody should abhor violence and extremism, hate, whether it comes from other communities or other ideologies or other religions. So I agree with you, and that's why I am very anxious that as we deal with this difficult issue in Birmingham, we don't stereotype a whole community, because it is only by working hand in glove with the many, many millions of patriotic, peace-loving, tolerant British Muslims that we can make sure that extremist ideologies, and particularly violent extremist ideologies, do not take root.
Quick response from you, Aisha.
My response is just that thank you for answering, and I completely agree that
something
needs to be done.
Sorry. All right, mate, that's good. That's great. As it's such a chord, I must move on because it's great, and let's hope that happens. But we've got so many people who want to get involved.
Okay,
actually, good luck. Back to you, Deputy Prime Minister.
Nadia in Ilford. Hello, Nadia.
Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Hello, hi. My question, I'll try and make it as brief as possible, relates to the Israel and Palestine situation.
Yep.
We all know that the conflict has rumbled on for now over 10 days, and in that time, over 200 Palestinians have been killed. The UN has said that 80% of those were innocent civilians. Half of them were women and children. And we've all seen the horrendous sort of footage that's coming across from Gaza on the ground. I've seen such traumatic footage of children, you know, mutilated and hurt in ways that we would never sort of, you know, it really does hurt seeing that footage. Also, yesterday we all heard on the news about those four young boys who were sort of who were shelled on the beach whilst playing football or something in Gaza. All this is really upsetting.
I've got to move you to your question, Nadia.
It's tantamount to war crimes. What I want to know, my question in particular, is the Prime Minister has remained strangely silent up to now on the issue. There's been no condemnation. In his place, should it not be, or could you not then issue a statement condemning this as war crime?
So, Nadia, to be fair to the Prime Minister, he was at a European Union summit just last night, which actually did issue a pretty clear condemnation of the levels of violence and the truly unimaginable humanitarian suffering in Gaza. I mean, frankly, regardless of what side you are on this ancient, bloody conflict, no one can feel indifferent to the spectacle of this overcrowded, desperate sliver of land, Gaza, where so many thousands of people are suffering. I will always defend, and I've done it on this programme before, Israel's right to respond and to defend itself in the face of violence that is designed to terrorise Israeli citizens. I've spoken out repeatedly about Israel's very legitimate demands that Hamas and others recognise Israel's right to exist and to exist peacefully within its own borders and providing security to its own citizens. I have to say, though, I really do think now the Israeli response appears to be deliberately disproportionate. It is amounting now to a disproportionate form of collective punishment. It is leading to a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, which is just unacceptable. And I really would now call on the Israeli government to stop. They've proved their point.
Hamas would continue, though,
well,
Deputy Prime Minister.
No, Israel, of course, retains the right to react. But I'm just saying you cannot see the humanitarian suffering in Gaza now without concluding that and the very many numbers of deaths in Gaza, without concluding that there is not much more going to be served in Israel's own interest. And this is a point I keep wanting to make, because every time, of course, any politician speaks out, I can guarantee you I'll get lots of people kind of getting quite understandably quite passionate about this from one side. All I would say is, as someone who is a long-standing defender of Israel's right to defend itself, of Israel's right to defend its values and its own citizens, it is not in the long run in Israel's own interests to see this festering humanitarian crisis get ever worse in Gaza, because all it does, of course, in the long run, is act as a kind of almost as a sort of incubation, if you like. It incubates the next generation of violent extremists who want to do harm to Israel. So
they might argue, though, that Hamas would just carry on shelling.
Well, if Hamas does that, then of course Israel reserves the right to respond. All I'm saying is today we have the glimmer of hope that a 5-hour humanitarian ceasefire has been entered into by both sides. And my plea today to both sides is please build on that, because further deaths, more violence begetting more violence, is not in anybody's interest, and it's not going to help deliver the only way in which Israelis will be able to live in security and peace in the long run, which is a negotiated two-state peace settlement. It is the only way, and there's just no, you know, I know it's very easy as an outsider to pronounce on these things, but I really do think that the level of humanitarian suffering in Gaza now, the number of deaths, and the disproportionate, apparently almost deliberate use of disproportionate response, now needs to come to an end.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. But let's move on to, as we said, a radio first, an exclusive here on LBC. It's my pleasure to welcome to the studio Ross McEwan, who's chief executive of RBS. And it's only recently that we haven't really seen those words, troubled bank RBS. Those words do seem to vanish as Mr. McEwan and his team try and get the bank back on track. Ross McEwan is, as I say, in the studio with me. Mr. McEwan, you're a man who likes a challenge.
Good morning. I certainly like a challenge, and we've got one here. But underneath all of this, there is a fantastic bank that we just need to get much better for customers.
How are you going to get out from under the sort of coverage that you've endured and let your customers and let the world know what you're telling me is a great bank inside?
Yeah, look, we've got some great businesses sitting underneath the RBS banner. We just need to focus all of those businesses on the customer and their needs. And unfortunately, that's something since I've been up here a couple of years, looking at the banking sector, we've got a lot to do in this marketplace, but we can do it.
It's important to say, before people start hurling abuse at you, you relatively recently arrived in this job. When did you take it up, Mr. McEwan?
I took the job up about 10 months ago, so relatively new, and
You were in Australia, you were running a big successful bank down in Oz.
Yes, I was looking after the retail bank for Commonwealth Bank.
Had you been on the Shiraz when they phoned you or something? What on earth made you say yes?
It's a desire for a challenge, I'd say. But also, look, when I looked at it, I thought they've got some fantastic brands. We've got positions in this marketplace that we can turn this back into one very, very good bank for the British public.
How long?
I think we've got another 2-3 years of very hard work, but it started. And I think that's important for people to understand. It has started. Lots to do, though. And
will we get our money back? 46 billion quid.
My job is to create you a really good bank, so you've got a good chance of doing that.
So you reckon we'll get it all back?
I didn't say that, but I'll tell you what, we're on path to making a good bank for you. And by having a good bank, you'll get a good price for it, and that's the objective. But the price will be what the market will pay.
Headphones are on, Mr. McEwan. Perhaps put on your battle jacket. We're off. Sarah in Cobham, you're through to the boss of RBS. Go ahead, Sarah. Good morning.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, I just wanted to find out from Ross McEwan whether bonuses will be paid to all divisions within the RBS group, including the global restructuring group. This is considering the huge financial harm this division in particular has caused to so many SMEs. I work for a small property company who have in the past repaid millions on loans with RBS. They've never defaulted on any loans at all. Yeah, they were sent to GRG with the intention, and I know that it was the intention of putting the company into administration. So their property assets were, you know, about to be put into the RBS West Register, and they were forced to pay considerable amount of fees by forcing valuations that were manipulated by RBS's preferred valuers. And I just wanted to know how, after so much harm, caused, and you know, it's emotional and financial harm that they've caused, how on earth morally they would be able to allow to get bonuses be paid for this.
Let's hear from Mr. McEwan.
Yeah, first off, it is a hugely emotional issue. I understand when people, their businesses start to have difficulty, and we have to step in and help out in any shape or form. I just understand that. We've had a number of criticisms around GRG. We've done our own, or had our own independent review, and the Financial Conduct Authority are also doing a review at the moment. I'm very happy if you've got an individual case that you want me to look at, I'll give you the email address, very happy to pick it up.
You're doing a lot of work just to finish off that point.
Well, the actual review came through because it was one of those things that really hits at the heart of a bank, which is around trust. And that's what Sarah's talking about there, trusting the bank to do the right thing. And our independent report showed that this is a pretty good unit. It was under huge pressure because the number of cases coming in there went up about 8 to 10 times within a 3-month period of time when the financial crisis hit. And it'd be fair to say we lent out money that we should never have lent out to people we should have probably said no to when we were trying to grow this bank stupidly over a 5 to 10 year period. And I think we did some damage. That's very clear. I have not seen, though, malicious, fraudulent activity going on in this part of the business, and that's why we did our independent review report on it. But I'm happy to pick up Sarah's case.
Sarah, stay on the line, talk to one of my team, and then we can put it across to Mr. McEwan or one of his assistants, and they can take care of that aspect of it. Thank you. Terry's in Chelmsford. You're on the radio, Terry.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, Terry, go ahead. Your question.
Yes, my question is, why is it that 6 years after the crash, the former directors of RBS, who had statutory duties in their stewardship of the bank, have not yet been held to account for their negligence, possibly even criminal negligence, in their taking the bank to the brink, of bankruptcy. It seems to me that if you're a director, you do have certain responsibilities, and so far all I've seen is directors ducking and diving. They do need to be held into account. And Mr. McEwen spoke about rebuilding the relationship with customers. I think one of the first things the bank needs to do, or more probably the authorities, is to make sure that justice is meted out in the right and proper way.
Yeah, look, Terry, I know, again, this is hugely emotional for what happened to this bank. It had to be saved by the public of the UK, not just because of the bank, because of how important it is to the whole financial position of the UK and businesses. It's really up for the authorities if they think people have done things that are illegal to actually take them up. Those people are no longer with our bank. We've got a completely new board. You've got 99% of the executive team is different, new people going forward. I've got to tell you, my focus is on the go forward for this bank, because that's where the value is, and how do we recreate a really good bank here.
Just coming back to the idea of bonuses, I'll bring Terry back in a second. We talked in the first question. Broadly speaking, do you support the idea of bonuses?
I support the idea of incentive payment for where people are focused on doing good things for customers and the overall bank, and they have to connect. You can't have one without the other, where you'll get more actual results out of that. Where you don't, you shouldn't be paying them.
Do you get a bonus?
For 2 years, no, I don't. I actually said I'd rather focus on getting this business going, and I gave mine up for the first 2 years in the job, so that we can just get focused on getting this bank moving again and doing the right things by our staff and our customers again. And take that away.
I'm picking up on Terry's point, and you acknowledged this twice, Mr. Coon, to your credit, but there's considerable anger towards Fred Gouverneur and others, and also the fact that taxpayers have paid almost £500,000 in legal fees. Now, I know this isn't down to the RBS, but it is the hostility that continues to surround your brand, is it not?
Oh, look, it is. And, you know, that's going to be another thing that comes up next year in court when the 2008 share issue comes up and has a day, and it'll be, again, something we have to deal with publicly while our people just get on and do good things for the customers. But I can't just get distracted by this stuff. I've got to create the bank for the future, which is a really good bank for customers, and that's where I need to spend 95 to 99% of my time.
Before it went made stupid decisions, you called them, can you get it back to where it was?
I don't want to get it back to where it was.
No, prior to making those decisions?
Yeah, we can, because we've got great people, we've got very good brands, we've got actually good product sets, and we just need to focus that back on what's really important, which is the people and the customers of our bank.
So,
not trying to grow for the sake of just sheer growth.
So to that end, would you ever split, say, commercial from investment banking?
Well, we've done that in the sense of having a look at how I've shaped their business today. We've gone from 7 businesses to 3. We've got a big personal and small business bank, because they fit together. They're usually the same customer groupings. We've got a mid-sized corporate and our private bank together, and our large corporate and institutional bank is also separate as well. So, effectively, we've done that.
Pius is in Chingford. Pius, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, Ross. My question is, in the light of recent banking scandals in the last 2 years regarding rate rigging, interest rate swaps and loans to SME, What has the bank done to prevent the reoccurrence of such bad behaviour by the bank by the bankers? Mm. And in addition, does the bank think that it has dealt with all the historic bad behaviour and that those will not occur in future?
Pars, look, can I just go into the last one first? The answer is no. And I've got to be quite open and honest with you. No, we haven't. There are a number of litigation and conduct issues that we are still having to grapple with that will come out over the next 18 months. We've sort of got a very good handle on what those will be, because they're sort of wandering through court, or they've been very public, and we've been quite open about them, with particularly with our investors. So I'm sorry they're not, but what we're doing is creating a bank that doesn't create those things going forward. And that's important. Otherwise, you just keep rolling on for the next scandal or problem. So we've been dealing with a whole raft of issues that will make it a better bank. And I've just announced some of those recently, like some of the behaviours around giving a new customer a better deal than an existing customer. I just find that abhorrent in the marketplace. And it's rampant here in the British banking arena. Same with these things.
This is the newbies campaign, I think, that I see when I go into the bank. Yeah. Why do the newbies get the best deals?
Why do you give a new customer a better deal than an existing customer? Somebody who's done 30 years of customer, why would they get a worse deal than somebody who walked in today? I just find that abhorrent. And we've gone through some of these things and said that's just unacceptable. Same with giving people a credit card with a zero. If you move your other balances across, you know what's going to happen at the end of that 12 or 18-month period of time. They'll get stuck on it, and then they'll be paying 18 to 20%. I mean, when do we stop doing this stuff? That's what we've determined to stop in our bank. Get back to good banking, the way it used to be 20-odd years ago, when actually we also said no to people when we thought they were getting into too much debt. That would be a new thing.
The market, there seems to be a sense, Mr. McEwen, that the foreign exchange fixing by banks could be a more expensive scandal than LIBOR or PPI. Do you think that might be right?
Look, it has the hallmarks. Unfortunately, it has the hallmarks. We're still doing a lot of investigation. We're going through just millions and millions of emails, chat rooms, conversations to see what actually went wrong, if anything, in this area here. And unfortunately, I have the feeling that it is a sort of a LIBOR case again that we're getting on top. The difference this time is that we haven't sat back and denied it. We've got into it and doing the investigation hand in hand with the authorities. And again, I'd like to see it cleaned up as quickly as we can so that we get these things that Pryce was talking about, the things of the past moving forward. We need a better bank.
It could be bigger.
I don't know, to be honest, at this stage. It's not a small one.
All righty. More calls to Ross McEwen in just a second. Travel follows this.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on...
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. And the last time our guest was in, we learnt the lesson that he was hugely popular. He's, of course, Sir Michael Wilshaw, who's from Ofsted, the chief inspector of schools. The phones rang continually, so many of you. And when you realise how important, of course, the education of our children is, and how many stories that we talk about each day, how many of them touch education or schooling, you realise just why it's so good to have Sir Michael back. Thank you for coming along, Sir Michael.
Good morning.
And if you'll allow me, we're going to go straight to the first call. Already the phones are lighting up, as they say. Mohammed is in Birmingham, and you're through to Sir Michael Wilshaw. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Hi. My question really is, I mean, it's about the school I'm in Birmingham. We were judged inadequate recently by the inspectors, although we've only been in post for 90 days as a governing body. Although I believe that we'd have done more in the prevention strategy than any other local school, it was completely ignored by the inspectors. Historical data from the older school was used against the school, and it became quite obvious that the intention of the inspectors was to support the Trojan horse hysteria. I mean, currently, parents and governors have no confidence in Ofsted and in Sir Michael Wilshaw, and this was also relayed to him when he had his visit in Birmingham, and he seen the anger from the parents at a meeting, which I was also there. My question is, why is Ofsted no longer independent?
We are independent, and it's good to speak to you, Mohammed. And I probably saw you at the meeting I attended the other week in Birmingham. I was impressed by that meeting at the number of parents who wanted the issues resolved and wanted the schools to get back to normality and the youngsters to receive a good education. It's deeply upsetting what is happening in Birmingham. You've read our report. We've been very clear that this is about governors abusing their position. It's about governors overstepping the mark. The job of governors is to set the strategic direction of the school and hold the head teacher to account. It's not to get involved in the day-to-day running of the school, undermine the authority of the head teacher, and to turn the school from what is a non-faith schools into faith schools through the back door, through a number of means. And we were very clear in our report that this cannot continue.
Mohammed?
But, I mean, we've only been governors for 90 days. I think this is what I'm trying to stress to you. So if you're saying we've done all this colluding and all this kind of enforcing of conservative Islamic views upon the children, all this within 90 days, we've barely had a meeting. So you've just damn the school, damn us as a governing body, when we hadn't even had a chance to even approve our second policy.
Yeah, yeah, well,
so,
you know...
I mean, it's heartbreaking to me as a parent, because I've been involved in governors for our children to ensure that they achieve what they're able to achieve. But this, what we've been judged on by the time limit that we've been given, 90 days...
Well, let's get some... I won't cut you off, ma'am.
It's a job of governors to ensure that the schools are run according to the law, that tolerance is promoted, not intolerance, that you run a curriculum that is broad and balanced, that you give youngsters the opportunity not only to be nourished in their own faith, but also have an awareness, a knowledge, and an appreciation and a tolerance of other faiths, other cultures and other styles of living. And that is what we didn't see in the schools in Birmingham. In fact, we saw the reverse. Intolerance being promoted and a narrowing of the curriculum and youngsters being given a false perspective on what it must be like to live in modern Britain. And that is the responsibility of governors to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Mohammed,
I'm glad you brought up the curriculum and how our youngsters should be, because, I mean, our schools failed on its SRE policy and also the religious education curriculum and the policy. Mm. But coincidentally, the two local schools that at the same time were kept the outstanding and good Ofsted rating had exactly the same policies. Yeah. I mean, as exactly the same curriculum as us. Yeah. So, I mean,
well, can I just interrupt you there, Mohammed?
Hold on, Mohammed.
You make that point that we saw 21 schools in Birmingham. There were a number of schools that we saw with large Muslim populations, school populations, that were doing fantastically well. That the governors there were on the ball, they knew exactly what their role was, the head teacher knew what his or her role was. They made sure that the curriculum was appropriate, they made sure that the Muslim children in the school were nourished in their faith, but also had an understanding of other cultures and other faiths. And these were outstanding schools and good schools. But in a number of schools, the reverse that we saw, the reverse was true. And the governors were culpable as far as Ofsted was concerned.
Mohammed, thank you. Just to give background, of course, Ofsted carried out inspections at 21 schools in Birmingham between March and May last year as part of the Trojan Horse investigation. 5 schools were subsequently placed in special measures, and head teachers, it was found, had been forced from their jobs. Inspections were conducted following claims of a takeover plot by a radical Muslim, the so-called Trojan Horse. Sir Michael, was there a Trojan Horse?
Well, we don't know the authenticity of this letter. What we did know that there were deep concerns in Birmingham. We acted not only on the Secretary of State's letter to us to ask us to inspect, but also we acted on the concerns of both parents and teachers who had written to us about their misgivings and concerns about the schools in which their children were working and teachers were working. So we intervened well before the Secretary of State wrote us this letter. What we did see was, as I said, manipulation by governors. What we did see was intolerant attitudes being promoted rather than tolerant attitudes, a narrowing of the curriculum, and that wasn't fair on the children going to those schools. And we were very clear in our letter to the Secretary of State that things had to change.
You were challenged about the reliability of inspections by a panel of MPs, Sir Michael. It is fair to say that in January of last year, some of these schools were judged as outstanding, and by the middle of this year, you're virtually sending in the Marines. What's wrong with the inspection system?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the inspection system.
Well, something is outstanding in January of last year. Inadequate a few months, just over a year later.
Well, again, in my submission to the Select Committee, I made it very clear that schools can decline very, very quickly when leaders depart.
Absolutely.
And what happened here was the leaders were pushed out, head teachers were pushed out, intimidated, marginalised. And as a result of that, there was huge staff turbulence in some of the schools that we visited, polarisation of staff, loss of staff morale, and so on and so forth. And in that sort of context, schools can go down very quickly. In my experiences, I've worked in special measures schools to try and turn them around. Things can decline very quickly. Within weeks, you don't have to wait a year or 2 years. Schools can be derailed very quickly indeed.
And just lastly on this, Birmingham City Council Chief Executive Mark Rogers, who's a former head teacher himself, as indeed are you, Sir Michael, accused you of playing politics.
Absolutely not. We've said that Birmingham didn't listen to the complaints of heads over a period of time. Head teachers were saying to Birmingham, this is what's happening. We're being bullied. We're being intimidated. We're being marginalised. Governing boards are being infiltrated. They'd made a large number of submissions to Birmingham Council, and Birmingham Council hadn't listened.
How are relations between you and the chief executive of the council now?
My relations with everyone is absolutely fine, but we have to tell the truth, Ofsted.
Derek's in Islington. You're through to Sir Michael. Go ahead, Derek.
Yes, good morning, Sir Michael.
Good morning.
Credit where it's due for coming onto the airwaves and dealing with questions from the public.
Thank you.
I'm calling as a regional primary school sports manager engaged in supporting PE professional development within primary schools. It's on the back of the primary PE premium. I've received comments from a number of schools that what is meant to be happening via inspection, as issued by your guidelines published on the 1st of September last year, that it's rarely actually occurred. So my question is, why is the primary PE premium not receiving the consistent degree of inspection as promised, as it's only serving to devalue the strategy? I mean, I have got one suggestion to offer how maybe this situation can be remedied, but your thoughts first, if you don't
mind me asking. One of the jobs that inspectors do when they visit schools is to look at how additional funding is being used by the head teacher and governors of the schools we're inspecting. So we look very closely at the pupil premium funding, for example, to see whether that funding is being used effectively to close the gap between youngsters on free school meals and those not on free school meals. And we're also looking at the pupil at the sports premium in primary schools to see whether, in fact, there are extracurricular activities going on, whether PE is being enhanced in the school, whether children are leading healthy and active lives. So that's part of our new inspection framework. These are early days because the pupil premium has only just come in. So it'll be time before we write a survey report on this to see whether the additional funding is working. It's quite interesting you ask this question at the moment, because in a few days' time, we'll be publishing the latest survey on how well the pupil premium is being used nationally. So you'll have to wait and see what we say about that. But we will be writing about the school's use of the sporting premium in the next few weeks and months.
Quick response from you, Derek.
Yeah, I was going to really say that the typical Ofsted report provides no real separate paragraph scope for feedback on either the pupil or the sport premium, where the opportunity to comment upon spend and impact for both would raise their status and significant contribution for learning. And I really do have to call into question that if the quality of inspection, certainly from what we've seen, and you know, I work with national agencies, and I know that they've received many complaints. Complaints is strong, but
yeah.
Comments.
Well, I'd ask you to look at our reports in September once the framework has been revised. If you look at our reports now, there's a paragraph that's written on how schools use the pupil premium, and you'll see a similar sort of paragraph, or certainly much more comment on how primary schools are using the sporting premium.
Derek, thank you. Sarah in Croydon, you're through to Sir Michael.
Hi, I'm calling on behalf of my husband, who's currently a teacher, and he could possibly lose his livelihood due to unfounded allegations. He was dismissed earlier this year, and he's been referred to the DBS and NTCL. This is around the allegations of inappropriate behaviour. So I want to find out what you are going to do to protect teachers like my husband from being dismissed from work where there's been unfounded allegations and he could possibly lose his livelihood.
Well, if unfounded allegations are being made by various people, parents and against members of staff, their process is to go through. There's a complaint process that the school has to have. The particular member of staff can appeal to the governors. The governors have got to take action and listen to any appeals.
I'm Nick Ferrari, and you've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm away all next week, so join Andrew Pearce at breakfast Monday morning from 7, and I'll be back with you from Monday the 28th. And in fact, Andrew is up next with his Saturday breakfast show after the news at 7. This is LBC.